You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 136. During the American Nuclear Society annual meeting held in Atlanta, Georgia in June 2009, I had the opportunity to sit down with Jack Tuohy, the executive director for the ANS. Jack is a longtime participant in the nuclear industry in the U.S. and around the world. He has some goals for openness and future education to improve the ability of the nuclear industry to change the world. Hope you enjoy our conversation.
So you came to ANS out of industry.
Actually, my background's pretty diverse in that I got my formal education in mechanical engineering, and I got a master's in nuclear engineering. And worked for an architect engineer for 20 years, for Burns and Rowe.
Okay.
And was involved from 1970 to 1990, working through the early stages of the industry when things were going extremely well. We had a couple hundred plants on order and working hard and a lot of enthusiasm. And then, with the recession in the 70s, and this is sort of an interesting thing, because I've given a talk recently where I reflected back on this time, but you had the exuberance, the excitement, much like it is today, and then you had a period of very high inflation, recession, everybody worried about energy security, and I'm sitting here thinking, boy, we had this brief period where we're talking about a renaissance and we're all getting excited, and now we're looking at inflation, double-digit inflation maybe on the horizon, and rising interest rates, and I'm thinking, wow.
Is this a flashback to about 1974, 1975?
Yeah, precisely.
It's incredible to me because many people still to this day point to 1979 as the end of the first nuclear era.
Right.
Yet the order stopped.
Yes.
In 1973.
Yeah.
The cancellation started.
Yes.
In 74.
Yeah, that's true. You're right. Not everybody realizes that. A lot of people thought TMI was the thing that, it was actually. Ironically, TMI actually resulted in a lot of work for the industry because I was one of the responders, one of the first responders at TMI, because Burns & Rowe was the architect engineer for that plant. And so when the accident happened, they needed resources, and of course you come to the architect engineer that designed the plant. I was there within a couple of days, and my wife didn't see me for a good deal of time after that. We were busy. But just an interesting point from that time. I remember one night working in a trailer on the island. It was maybe 11:30 at night, and just I could go for days where I didn't talk to my wife. And I figured, let me just grab a minute before she goes to bed. And I called her up, and she was glad to hear from me. And she says, "Oh, they're saying this on the news, and that on the news, and this on the news." And I remember thinking, well, I said, if that's true, I'm in big trouble because I can pick up a stone, and if I get a good heave out of it, I can probably hit the containment building or come close, So at that point is when it first registered that the industry has a lot of work to do in terms of, the interface with the public, and as we learned later, not just the public, but the governor wasn't quite sure what was going on either. And incidentally, Harold Denton, who President Carter sent to TMI for just that reason, to find out what's really going on, he's here at the meeting. And I saw him yesterday. And so that's he was an important figure in helping to establish credibility with the public.
Well, back then, even the NRC wasn't really sure what to do. Guys like Bradford and stuff, just they actually stoked the fires of some of the fear, from what I can tell.
Yeah, yeah. But Denton was good. He came and helped, you know, I guess, figure out what the actual situation was, or the extent to which we understood it at the time. Mm-hmm. We really didn't fully appreciate everything that had happened.
So you were involved in the construction of how many plants?
Well, I worked at Oyster Creek, worked on Three Mile Island, worked on Forked River, but that was never completed. Did some work on Clinch River. Did a lot of work at backfitting, as I said. The lessons learned from Three Mile Island resulted in a lot of work for engineers to go back and backfit a lot of the systems. And, Radway's treatment is another thing. All the early plants, they were worried about producing electricity, not treating radioactive waste. So through the 70s and 80s, there was a lot of work being done to try to take care of the low-level waste treatment systems at nuclear plants. And what would inevitably happen is you design a system for the plant, and then they go to operate it, and they'd be very unhappy with it, and then you'd have some mobile vendor would pull into your truck bay and provide the service. And with that little bit of information, I'll tell you a really good story. Around 1985, we did a state-of-the-art design for TVA for Sequoia and Watts Bar. They were going to be identical, state-of-the-art radioactive waste treatment systems. Just beautiful facilities. And at that point, I understood the processes very well. I was very good at layouts. You know, there's a lot that goes into a layout. It was a piece of work, you know. Really, I was very proud of it. We were down and presented it to TVA. We had been working with their design staff, but now they brought the operators in. And they sat there and they looked at the design and they said, well, that's really great. And one guy says, the only problem is I want two truck bays. I said, oh, geez, I'm thinking this is a big impact. You know, that's a big change. But we can do it. I said, but you mind telling me why? He goes, well, you guys keep giving us systems that don't work. I want to have an extra truck bay to put the mobile system that I'm going to probably end up using. And, I mean, that's a great story because it gives you insight into the relationships that exist and still exist today, you know.
Yeah. There's not sometimes a lot of trust involved after a couple of systems that were difficult to operate.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw Rod Stahl yesterday leaving one of the meetings, and I had kind of made this point, and he was laughing. You know, he said, yeah, that sort of bantering, I don't think it's a real conflict. It's really bantering that goes on between design and operations. You know, the operators all think the designers are idiots, right? I mean, they don't really, but they feel it's their duty to say that.
Yeah,
you know,
I'm an operator, and when I was on board submarines, we used to complain a little bit about some of the design choices that were made. One of the things that the nuclear Navy's always done is that they've always claimed that they had the designers actually walk around in various places in a mock-up and make sure that you could have access. The only problem was the guy that they sent down to do that was Admiral Rickover. He was only 5 feet tall and weighed 110 pounds, okay?
So, yeah, right. Yeah.
So we had a lot of places where he could get, but the rest of us couldn't.
Yeah, not necessarily the standard man.
Yeah. Yeah, the size equivalent man was not exactly there. So. Yeah. Tell me a little about why you've come to ANS and what kind of goals you have for the organization.
Well, you know, as I mentioned, I spent 20 years at Burns & Rowe. I spent 13 years teaching. I love to teach, mostly part-time. 3 years was full-time. But and then, you know, and I spent the 90s doing decommissioning because
that's what everybody did in the 90s, D&D, right?
Yeah. And then in the year 2000, I came back to Burns & Rowe, led their group for 3 years, and the nuclear group, and then went to the Shaw Group, where I led the effort to try to win the M&O contract at Idaho National Lab. And although we didn't win, it was a very disappointing loss after you put a couple of years of your life into something. But still, I developed relationships with lots and lots of people, putting the team together and then competing against the other teams and making a case for, you know, why we were the best team to help bring nuclear technology to benefit society. And that's really, like, if you look at Idaho National Lab, and it's getting to your question, I think I'll provide an answer, but if you look at Idaho National Lab, you know, what they're really trying to do is connect, you know, the science with the application, you know, which is a something not everybody always thinks about, that, you know, you need to make that leap. And they're good at that, and it would have been so fulfilling to be able to do that, because I really, like most nuclear people, they when they went into this field, it was a very conscious decision. They had the insight to see the enormous benefits that can come from this technology, and they maybe sensed the frustration of dealing with the public that maybe doesn't understand it, and because of that, are vulnerable to folks who try to take advantage of that lack of understanding. And so you end up with people who are passionate, really smart, highly motivated, altruistic mainly. You don't subject yourself to this business unless you really care, you know. And so so from there, you know, I consulted with the South Africans for a couple of years on the pebble bed, and then I went to Hitachi, and I was happy, you know, just working with the terrific people at Hitachi. That you ask a tiny question, the next day you have 6 inches of paperwork answering, you know. It was so wonderful just to see the level of expertise, you know, that exists, and the continuity in developing nuclear energy in Japan, which we didn't have in this country. And their willingness, the sense, this was interesting, you know, they have a sense that, hey, we have, in Japan, at Hitachi, you know, that we have nuclear energy here because of our relationship with America, you know, GE in the case of Hitachi. And they recognize that, you know, our industry is atrophied here, and they see this as, hey, we have an opportunity to return the favor. Genuinely, you know, mm-hmm. that's a motivation. The business sense there is not quite the same as here. They operate at a nice level, I think, you know. And so I see this in the industry, and then I had the opportunity to lead the American Nuclear Society in the position of executive director, and I figured, wow, you know, this is a case where I can work kind of for the industry, you know, or not so much for the industry, but for the people mm-hmm. that have chosen this as their profession to maybe help them lead more fulfilling lives, you know, because they worked hard in school to get the education, they work hard in their jobs to develop their skills, and you know, maybe there's something I can do here to just help them bring this wonderful technology to society and help overcome some of the hurdles that really shouldn't be there. In a sense, it's a little bit like electricity was 100 years ago, you know, all of these crazy things, you know. I mean electricity has to be respected, and by the same token, you know, most technologies have to be respected in one sense or another, but you gotta, you know, not just fear it, you know, understand it, and that's maybe what motivated me to do
well, you know, it's interesting you bring up the introduction of electricity, because one of the things that, if you know that story pretty well, is that there was a lot of fear being used in the salesmanship of the two different choices of electricity. I mean, Thomas Edison was trying to convince everyone that AC was extremely dangerous and that it was used to kill people in the electric chair so that his DC power would be more favorable.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, the sense of fear was being used as a sales technique. One of my theories is that that's one of the reasons why people have a fear of nuclear energy, is that they've been taught to fear it by the competition.
Ah, that's an interesting thought.
When you look at advertising and salesmanship, there's a couple of things that really come into play in all kinds of products all around the world, is that sex sells and fear prevents a sale. But if you're the guy who's selling the competitor, that's just as valuable to you.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's something to think about. I don't think that this fear of, and the other thing to think, go back, you know, you're of an age where you were in the time when everybody was more positive about the benefits that can come from nuclear technologies. You probably entered the field in a time when there wasn't much opposition. Everybody's right. Pretty excited about it.
Absolutely.
And that was 20 years closer to the explosions than we were when we got started getting afraid of it.
Yeah, it's ironic, I guess. Yeah, it's true.
So yesterday you hosted a session that involved some investors, which was kind of interesting to me to see that at an ANS meeting.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, part of in coming to ANS, I figured, you know, I need to, I don't want to sit in my office, you know. I know that Hewlett Packard things, management by wandering around, so I think my predecessor didn't do that too much around the country or around the office, you know. I mean, different people have different styles, and the way it became really evident to me is occasionally I want to talk to someone in the office, and, you know, Connie would say, you want me to call him and have him come down? I said, no, I'll just run up. You know, I have a lot of energy. And I popped into people's offices, and initially the reaction was like, what did I do?
Am I in trouble? D-E-D-G.
I must have really screwed up if he's here. You know, when I realized that, I just pop it in, you know. And so that's sort of my style in general. And so I figured not only would in the office with the staff, but also with the members. And so I've kind of made a conscious effort, probably went overboard because I'm pretty tired. But I've spoken to the Chicago
local. It's the third day of a conference. You're supposed to be tired.
Yeah. But I've done a lot of travel. And at the Chicago section, I spoke there and up at Seabrook and in New England and Delaware Valley and
Tennessee recently.
Yeah, right, at the Nuclear Fuel Services. Got designated as a National Historic Landmark, for us. Just an aside, this is worth pointing out. When I had to say a few words at the ceremony a week ago, and I noted, I said, you know, you guys are kind of special. I said, because most of these landmarks are, you'll find them hanging up like at EBR1 and things that existed a long time ago and the dust is gathering. I said, you guys are still a vibrant entity and we're giving you an historic landmark award. And the management there, a couple of guys come up to me and said, gee, you know, we hadn't really thought about that, but that's just an aside. So in the course of going around, I want to meet the people, the student section, their conference, I spoke to them. And so it gives you a chance to get a sense of who the members are, what they're thinking about, what their concerns are. They get to know me, so they feel that they have a connection with headquarters and they can give me a call or send me an email if I can help out with something. In the course of doing that, I was going through Washington. I know some folks there, and I know Pillsbury Winthrop has an energy group. I figured, let me go in and talk to them. I know a few of the people there. And so I did. I gave one of my talks to a small group, five people. It was intimate. And then Chuck Peterson, who's there, he says, hey, we're having a lunch. Come on, we'll treat you. So he went down and I have a luncheon speaker. Mm-hmm. And the luncheon speaker was this alternate financing. And I was thinking, this is pretty interesting. And so I started talking to these fellows, and they're doing business in China. And I'm thinking, our members, are doing business in China. And I have this thought, too, that engineers, in the past, when I was young, you had to work for a big company to get the resources to do the drawings and the typing and all of this stuff. Now with, modern technology, you can run a consulting business with just a few people, maybe just yourself, and be pretty productive. And so a lot of people, including myself, I formed my own LLC a few years ago, are looking at starting their own businesses, and some of them grow. I figured, wow, this could be a real service to our members, because people, kids, like when I went to school, I think I'm going to be an engineer. But when I taught, I taught the students, I said, you may be engineers, but don't ever forget you're also businessmen. You've got to make a living. And whether or not you have a degree in it, you're a businessman. And so I figured this is great just to provide a service to our members to engage in something like this. So that was where it came from. And I gather that people who went learned a lot about finance. You know, I mean, if you're a nuclear engineer, you're a smart guy, and you're probably curious about everything in the world, and this was an opportunity to listen to some of the deals that are being constructed. And of course, they're a reputable group. You know, Pillsbury Winthrop's a kind of an integral part of the nuclear industry, you know, and so they're reputable, and the guys they brought in to speak were young and articulate, and it's interesting. I think it is.
There were some tweets on it.
Oh, really?
I just wanted to let you know, yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
I hope they were favorable.
Yes.
Yeah.
I like the idea of thinking about the service to the members, and I want to go back a little bit to the point about making the industry more vibrant and more respected, so that somebody who is really working hard and trying to do good for the world doesn't have people saying bad things about what they do for a living every day.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. You know, when I was a lot younger in the 70s, and then the anti-nuclear movement started picking up, and I was, like, confused. And you know, occasionally you maybe engage one of these guys, and you just walk away very frustrated because you just feel like this. You know, I was too young and inexperienced to get a sense of really what was going on. But it wasn't, for the most part, I think the people opposing it were disingenuous in their arguments. I think their goal was that this nuclear power was inherently evil, and there was no arguing or any, and no convincing or no facts that were going to change their mind. And so it took me a couple of decades, I'm a slow learner, to figure that out, because I'm a straightforward guy, and I you know, you just don't appreciate that. But over time, you know, I've gained a little bit more insight into it, maybe, and you realize that, you know, you're dealing with tactics that maybe, you know, engineers just wouldn't necessarily appreciate, because engineers, I think, just tend to be pretty direct, straightforward people. That's how you get your business done. Mm-hmm. You don't try to, like, work an angle to convince somebody that a 2-inch pipe will work when you really need a 3-inch pipe. You know, you look at the facts, the flow rates, the pressure drops, you make your judgment, bigger pumps, smaller pumps. You just deal on that level. But a couple interesting things. You know, I think people you're dealing with are motivated, you know, in some sense, maybe it's almost a religion. You know, it's a belief they have, and for them to be convinced otherwise would almost be like having someone convert from one religion to another religion, you know, and it's a different sort of transition than you would have from an engineering perspective where you're deliberating ABWR or AP1000. It's different. So that's one thing.
Well, there is a little bit of religious fervor within the nuclear community. There's folks that are liquid metal reactor guys from day one, and other folks that are saying, you know, light water's okay and works fine, lasts a long time, and others that are gas reactor people that don't seem to be convinced by logical arguments one way or another.
Yeah, I guess maybe, that's true. I don't know that I characterize it as directly analogous. I see that as maybe, you know, maybe some ownership issues and passion, but it's not, but you're still, there's still, you know, you can still get down to a logical argument with them, and then at some point it comes down to judgment. But in the case of religion, it's not judgment, it's faith, you know, and I think that's sort of what you're dealing with there. People have faith that nuclear energy is somehow inherently evil, and that's the way. But one way this is interesting. I once went to a Sierra Club meeting.
Okay.
It was a year after 9/11. I remember that, and it was the quote, the perils of nuclear power, and I figured, well, this doesn't sound balanced. So I figured, you know, I spent my whole life, I'm busy, I raised 4 kids, and you know, you have a full-time job, and I wondered how people had time for this. But so I figured, said to my wife, I said, you know, we ought to go to this. You know, we have a responsibility. And my son, Mike, who's an engineer, and his wife, who is too, said, I'll go with you, Dad. You know, so we go to this meeting, and I it was clear it was my first Sierra Club meeting because I had a suit and tie on. So right away, they knew I was different. The four nerds just arrived. And so we walked in. I sit down, and oh, my goodness, there was someone from Hudson River Alliance, I guess, and he was introducing the speaker from that he had. He was a professional engineer. It was well into his 80s, and I recognized his name. He had been against nuclear power his entire life, although he didn't work in the field. Some of the statements he made were extraordinary, to the point where I figured if I had the time, I probably should write to the PE board in New Jersey and just let them know some of the statements. And I had a few pages of notes when I realized it was pointless to think I was going to be able to address all these issues. And one statement I do remember, he said at one point he remembered back to when he was a student and took an introductory course in atomic physics, and his professor leaned over his desk and clumps of hair were falling onto his desk suggesting exposure to radiation, you know. And I'm looking at the faces of the people in the room and they're just filled with fear, you know. And I'm thinking, oh, God, I felt so bad. And there was one statement like that after another. And so, at any rate, the talk ended, and a few people asked questions. And then I remember thinking, well, I'm not going to have come all this way and sat here and say absolutely nothing. So I figured I can't address all these points, but maybe I can make one point. I raised my hand, and the fellow from Hudson River Alliance, who I think was a nice guy, you know, I think he was genuine in his concerns and all, and he wasn't dressed in a very expensive suit by any means. You know, I think it was definitely felt he was doing a good thing. But he didn't have any technical background, I think, to to substantiate any opinion he had on the topic. But nonetheless, so he recognized me kind of enthusiastically because I think he thought I was with the press because I was writing a lot and was dressed nice. And I said, first, let me note that, you know, I took more than an introductory course in atomic physics. I said, in fact, I have a master's degree in nuclear engineering from MIT. And so I figured, all right, so that maybe establishes the fact that I know something on the subject. But then I pointed out that I had other options. You know, I had a fellowship in aeronautics and astronautics that I could have pursued. And so I said, I'm not in this field because I had to do this to earn a living. Because that's an argument people use often. I said I had other options. I specifically chose this profession because I could see the enormous benefits that come from nuclear science and technology. And that's the reason I went into it. And I said, I'm a responsible citizen of the United States. I've raised four children. My daughter's a physician. Point out my son Mike and his wife are engineers. My other two boys are professionals. One in public health, you know. Right. And so I said I wouldn't be party to some kind of evil plot to inflict harm on Americans just to make a buck, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I said I just wanted to point that out. And I figured I was about to sit down. And then this thought popped in my head. And I said, you know, one thing that just occurred to me is I said yesterday was the one-year anniversary of 9/11. I lived in the New York City area, so it's right. A significant thing up there. I said, and on the news, they defined a terrorist as someone who seeks to instill fear in the hearts of others. And I said, frankly, it just occurred to me that that's really what you're doing here. And I sat down. Well, the poor fellow from Hudson River Alliance, it was like I had said nothing else. He was so offended. And then I got insight into really what's motivating him is that, oh, my goodness, you know, here's this guy that's, you know, really thinks he's doing this enormously good thing for society, and here I just characterized him as equivalent to a terrorist. So he was quite offended, and I can understand why. I wouldn't want that analogy applied to me either. But I mean, it was just a thing that popped in my head. But in fact, that's what was happening there. These people were getting scared,
right.
Really scared, and I felt bad. And you know, I don't know if I allayed their fears. I probably didn't, but I tried.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that ANS can do, I think, differently than, say, NEI or other industry groups, is to try to build some relationships with some of these other nonprofits, the reputable ones,
yeah.
And try to understand, try to help them understand that that motivation that we have, why we do this. We're not in this certainly because we don't have options. I mean, I've never met an unemployed ex-nuke.
Right.
You know, they're not all in the nuclear industry anymore, but, you know, they all have skills that are, you know, translatable to many other fields.
Yeah, right. If you can get through that curriculum, you can get through almost anything. That's true.
And so the idea of actually talking to the Sierra Club and to folks with Natural Resource Defense Council or some of the big major groups, that, I mean, it seems like that would be something that would be a natural for, because most of us, if we want to self-define, we do define ourselves as environmentalists. We care about the environment.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's true. But again, you know, that's another interesting reaction I have to. You hear a lot of talk about, well, green technology, right? I say to my kids the other day, I said, what the heck is green technology? You know, again, looking at it like an engineer, not a salesman, right? What's the criteria that defines you as green technology? So I said, and I said this in the office, I said, I think just to make that point, if anyone talks about nuclear energy, tell them it's blue technology, right? And they'll say, well, what's blue technology? You know, I say, well, it's 21st century technology. And I figured blue is good because, first of all, it's going to provoke the question, you know, and it distinguishes you from green, which is just, the point is to say, it's just marketing,
right.
You know? And so you make that point, and then you get to discussing, well, why do you pick blue? And then, you know, I think, well, the Cerenkov radiation, right? It's a beautiful blue hue. I was at University of Missouri's 10-megawatt research reactor, and they had to drag me away. It was something mesmerizing about the Cerenkov radiation. It just is such a beautiful shade of blue and bright at that facility. In a sense, you know, marketing is something I think.
Well, plus the air. I mean, there's the sky when it's pretty is blue.
Yeah.
The ocean when it's pretty is blue.
Yeah.
Lakes are blue. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, actually, there's that's a good. You know, like we all regard nuclear energy as clean, but yet the public has a different perception, and this is an interesting point too. A lot of it, I think, stems from the fact that. The way we license reactors, you know, we deal with the NRC. Their job is to make sure they're safe. And so one way they do that is to concoct, you know, scenarios that they figure might be, you know, outrageously, you know, conservative or whatever. But their goal is to make sure it's safe, and you want to make sure you bound scenarios that maybe you haven't thought about. And so that's fine. It's a licensing exercise. There's a tendency, I think, for the public or the press to believe that these are real things and not just a way to design the plant safely.
Right, against a hypothetical situation.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea of sometimes we have this, what is it, the source term, where we assume that a certain portion of the core suddenly gets dispersed.
Yeah, well, that's a great example. And it ties in, actually, I don't know how many of your listeners will have last November's issue of Nuclear News, but in that, Ted Rockwell wrote an article that was absolutely great. Ted Rockwell, as you know, is an icon of the industry.
Yeah.
And it's still... I
mean, Ted's been on the show several times.
Oh, has he?
Yes.
Great guy. He wrote this article where he pointed out that, you know, if you apply conservatism after conservatism after conservatism, you don't necessarily get a conservative answer. He said you could get a wrong answer.
Right.
And one example is the point you just made. The source term, you know, we say 50% of the inventory in the core is released into the containment building. Half of that gets into the environment. So 25% of the inventory is released. And how does that happen? Non-mechanistic. You know, we don't know how it happens.
Deus ex machina. Somehow it occurs.
Yeah. And so, you know, so the evacuation plans and things are based on the fact that there's a very large fraction of the core inventory is released. The atmospheric dispersion coefficients are the most unfavorable. The the wind direction is toward the highest population. You assume a linear model for the effect of exposure to radiation as opposed to threshold. And so you put all these conservatisms one on top of the other, and you say, well, the exclusion boundary has to be so many miles away. And you end up with a situation like Shoreham, where someone then uses that argument to say, well, you're not going to be able to evacuate all these people, so let's throw away an $8 billion plant, right? And so now you have energy shortages. You're generating electricity using coal, which does have a health impact that Shoreham would not have had. So you're dealing with a fictitious, in a sense, well, fictitious is the wrong word, but you know, a predicted health impact from Shoreham that really is based on an accident scenario that's not real. And so if you looked at the real impact or the probable impact of that plant, it would be pretty benign compared to the real actual impact of whatever energy source replaced it.
Well, and even if you aren't using that kind of guesswork for your postulate, and you have it can direct wrong action.
Yeah.
Unsafe action, like what we did at Three Mile Island when we tried to evacuate an area, mm-hmm. which is far more dangerous in terms of putting people on the road and possibility of accidents and all the other things that happen if you try to move a large body of people. That's far more dangerous.
Right.
So as Ted says, it's the wrong answer.
Yes.
It's not a conservative answer. It's the wrong answer.
Yeah. And so it prompts the question of, like, well, how do you engage... Or develop a scenario or a basis for a scenario that would force you to make a realistic estimate or judgment on what the real impact of the plant would be.
Right.
I came up with an interesting scenario. Let's say, you know, there was a terrorist attack on Manhattan whereby they chose to black out the island by taking down transmission towers. And so that's, you know... That's not a real hard thing to do. They're not defended. They're all over the place. They're, you know, weak structures. So you could black out Manhattan, and it's happened before. And when that happens, there's real data to support the fact that people will die.
Right.
And so there's a real scenario that will result in death. So what's the alternative? Or how do you deal with that? You have a power supply located there in Manhattan, adjacent to the island, that could just pump significant amounts of power in a reliable, you know, prolonged way. And so you could put a coal plant there, in which case you're going to have the emissions from the plant and deal with the health consequences of that for normal operation. But then you have to be thinking about what if they tried to interrupt the supply of coal to that plant to keep the plant running. So that's an issue you'd have to deal with. The alternatives to that would be have a couple of 1,500 megawatt nuclear plants located there in the bay, right next to Manhattan, and let's have a study to see what would be the appropriate response. But in that kind of a study, you're not dealing with licensing scenarios. You have a different scenario here. So now you're dealing with you need to make an accurate assessment of what's the real likely impact of two plants there. And so, truthfully, I doubt we'd ever decide to put a couple of plants there, but just the fact that you would have that study would send the message to people and would generate data that would give people a sense of what the real risk is. Mm-hmm. And maybe give the people an appreciation for the extremes that we go as an industry to ensure that we operate safely, and that instead of criticism or concern, they should be giving us awards every year for the extraordinarily responsible way in which we conduct ourselves. So,
Jack, do you have any goals for your organization over, say, the next year or the next 5 years?
Well, I think... I'd like our members I'd like to create an ANS that allows our members to be more effective in terms of what they do. And that's one sort of general goal. But in substance, what that means is things like our standards group, we have people volunteering hours and hours, I mean days, working painstakingly on these standards. But the all they want is their out-of-pocket costs covered. I mean, what a deal. So I want to get a new revenue stream flowing into ANS that will support activities like this, where your dollars are really leveraged, where maybe you invest $100,000 and you get several million dollars worth of product. And that's what happens with standards. And they're vital. You know, if we're going to start building new plants, a lot of these standards are 20 decades old. They need, you know, so we need people to you know, bring these standards up to date. That's an urgent need. And unfortunately, we have a terrific guy, a lot of terrific people on that committee. Prasad Katambi is the head of the committee. Wonderful guy, he's retired, and now he's working full-time for free, you know, pushing this effort. That's one example. So we need IT systems in place that'll also help there to get them all commenting on the document at one location. With publications, we need to get better IT systems in place to help them with their that whole process. With Nuclear News, you know, what we do now, one thing we've begun is we distribute Nuclear News to every member of Congress every month. Figure they need to see, it's a very readable magazine. Figure if just 10% of the people there are reading it, it's a home run because they're getting information from a reliable source.
Well, I'm going to break in the middle of my answer to my last question. Have you ever considered putting at least some of the content from Nuclear News in a more accessible location online? I mean, I find that magazine to be extremely valuable, but I'm a member and I get it.
Yeah.
You can't find the articles online. I've taken some of the information and written articles of my own to put online, but it's a valuable source. And like you said, it's very readable.
Yeah, I guess we could. Again, you got to look at the business implications. And would people, you know, a lot of people join ANS so they can get the magazine. If I put it online, maybe for members it could be available online. I'd have to look at the business case. Yeah, there's a trade-off here between.
It's always a trade-off.
Yeah, I mean that's an interesting thing. If we could make it more of a commercial publication where it wasn't necessarily.
Because, I mean, a lot of magazines are finding that they make more money on advertising than they do on subscriptions.
Right.
And that if they can reduce the cost by not paying the printer and the paper and all that other stuff, their actual, what they get left over at the end is more.
Yeah.
It all depends on how you, I mean, it's hard. And then, so longer term goals, what other things you.
Well.
Yeah, 4 minutes.
It's
the last question.
Okay.
Okay. Longer-term goals. I mean, longer-term goals is that our members, that the society does what it needs to do to make sure that these new plants that are about to be constructed are done on time and on budget. I think we can play a vital role there because if the first few plants are run into big problems in terms of delays, cost overruns, it's going to really put a big bump in the road. We can play a really important role here. If you look at Japan with the ABWI, it's a great example. First concrete to fuel load, pretty much 40 months plus or minus a couple of months. One after the other, shows it can be done. The operation of those plants are great. So that means it can be done. Now we have to do it. And so to make sure that this happens, it means that you need, as like ANS, needs to establish a, what I call a kind of like a town hall type environment where people can come together and what are you doing? What problems do you have? How did you solve that? A type of thing. Because, I mean, it happened with me in the early 70s when the industry was kicking off and we had no idea about a lot of this stuff. We worked together. It didn't matter you worked for a competitor. You really were in the same industry. And the same thing's true here, is if one guy fails, we all fail. If one guy succeeds, we all benefit. And so I think that there's that understanding in the industry that, you know, we really need, if we could do this right, there's going to be so much business, no one's going to be worried about who got what. We're just going to be worried about how are we going to get the job done, right?
How do we staff up for that kind of challenge?
Exactly. And I think that's a really, really, if I had to pick the most important thing that we were facing, where we could contribute, it would be to make sure that that happens well. I think we can provide the forum for that.
I think you can too. Jack, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
I really enjoyed my conversation with Jack and with Tom Sanders, and feel like the American Nuclear Society is in good hands. We're at an important time in our technology's history. It's time to get out and help people understand why we are proud to be nuclear technologists. I was so excited to watch Kirk Sorensen's young girls, Kaya and Zoe, recite the periodic table. If you haven't seen that video, go visit Atomic Insights and see if you can find the video of the two young girls reciting the periodic table by heart. Really does your heart good. Makes you proud to be a geek. Hope you enjoy the Atomic Show and continue listening. Bye for now.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way. Such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adams way.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.